In this weekend's episode, three segments from this past week's Washington Journal. First, as a government shutdown looms on Capitol Hill, a closer look at federal spending and a new projection showing the federal budget deficit expected to hit $2 trillion this fiscal year. That conversation with Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Then Victor Cha of the Center for Strategic and International Studies discusses the recent meeting between Russia's Vladimir Putin and North Korea's Kim Jong-un and what it means for Russia's war against Ukraine. Plus, a conversation with Mary Dixon, an advocate for survivors of nuclear weapons testing in the U.S. during the 1950s and 60s. She'll discuss her push for compensation for victims of radiation exposure and the impact of the recent Oppenheimer movie. Now, Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget, about federal spending and rising deficits. We started by asking him to define deficit versus the national debt.
The deficit is how much we borrow each year, and the debt is how much we owe. It's the sum of all of our past deficits. So if you think about a credit card, the deficit is how much you've added to the credit card bill in 2023. The debt is how much you owe total.
Where are we at right now in 2023 with our deficit?
Well, there's different ways to measure it, but people like to talk about gross federal debt, which is $33 trillion. I like to look at debt held by the public as a share of the economy, because the bigger your income, the more debt you can afford. And we are very close to 100%, meaning that the debt is basically as large as a full year's worth of output.
Why? Why are we in this position that we're in right now?
There's no one thing, but the COVID crisis and the Great Recession before that included a lot of one-time borrowing that got us far from our historical average of 50% up to our 100%. Underlying that, we keep passing new tax cuts and new spending increases that widen our structural deficits. And then we have an aging of the population and rising healthcare costs that put pressure on some of our oldest programs like Social Security and Medicare to continue growing in cost over time.
Are we paying our credit card?
We're paying our credit card with new credit cards. So we are borrowing, we're probably going to borrow about $2 trillion this year of new stuff. Plus, we're going to borrow additionally to roll over some of the debt from previous years.
You, according to this new report put out last week from your organization, the deficit is rising faster than projected. Why?
So last year's deficit effectively was $1 trillion. This year's is going to be $2 trillion. You've got to remove some weird student debt stuff that never happened, but effectively the deficit has doubled. Part of the reason of that is it turns out 2022 was actually a high water point. We actually had a really good year in terms of tax collection from capital gains, from wages because inflation had gone into income first. And now things are normal. Unfortunately, $2 trillion is the new normal. Adding to that, the cost of Social Security and Medicare went up pretty sharply because of inflation, and our interest costs are as high as they've ever been, at least since the 90s, with the average interest rate on new debt 4%, 5%, even 5.5% in some cases.
Who's to blame for this?
We all are. I mean, we the voters need to take some responsibility because we love to have low taxes. We love government services and benefits. The politicians keep making promises they can't afford. They keep telling us, don't worry about the borrowing because this tax cut's going to pay for itself. Or this new spending program is so important, we don't need to worry about the debt. And frankly, many of the economists are to blame because when interest rates were low, they said, well, borrowing is cheap, let's do it. It didn't occur to them that interest rates were going to rise and we were going to roll over all of that cheap debt into what's now very, very expensive debt.
I want to show this chart from your report. It shows the divergence between spending and revenue over the years. What can you tell us about this? What has been happening?
Well, two things are happening. The one is we keep cutting taxes. So revenue has sort of a built-in growth to it. As incomes go up, revenue should be growing. But that doesn't happen if we keep cutting taxes. The other is we keep increasing spending. And that's sort of taken three forms. The one is new government programs. The second is one-time relief. Some of it made sense, some of it didn't, for example, for COVID. And then the third is we've allowed some of our largest programs, in particular Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, to continue to grow, basically completely unfettered. We've known that these programs are on an unsustainable track. Many of them have trust funds headed towards insolvency. If you're on Social Security now, that program is not able to pay full benefits starting in 10 years under the law because it will be insolvent. And yet we've done nothing to either bring those costs under control or to raise more revenue in order to finance them.
Why not?
Why not? Because it's hard. It's very fun to tell people, I gave you a tax cut. I protected your Social Security benefits. It's very hard to say, in the interest of the greater good, to save this program, we are going to have to raise the retirement age by 1 month every 2 years. You're going to have to pay a little bit more taxes on your income. Now, we can do it, especially if Republicans and Democrats got together and agreed not to beat each other over the head. But it's politically tough because nobody wants to pay more taxes. Nobody wants lower benefits.
The latest round of tax cuts came during the Trump administration. President Trump and Republicans were in control. They passed a package of tax cuts. There was a report in the paper last week about how much of those tax cuts will stay in place because President Biden has said that no one making less than $400,000 should see a tax increase. So their reporting said that much of President Trump's tax cut package stays in place.
Well, I think that's very possible. We cut taxes. Republicans cut taxes by about $2 trillion over 10 years in the Trump administration. And then they actually joined hands with Democrats to increase spending and cut taxes by a combined almost $3 trillion more. Now, many of those tax cuts are set to expire at the end of 2025. And although there's been some nice talk of paying for extensions, we haven't actually seen how they're going to do it. And I think there's a very big risk that the parties join together, not in the interest of responsibility, not by making the hard choices, but by extending or even expanding these tax cuts.
What do you think happens on the spending side? We're 8 working days away from a possible government shutdown. Republicans in the House, some conservative Republicans, are saying we need to address the spending now. Exactly what you're talking about. They want to spend $115 billion less than what the president and Speaker McCarthy agreed to in May.
Well, the Fiscal Responsibility Act, which was that May agreement, I think it was a really good start to get our spending under control. Democrats and Republicans came together on a plan to essentially freeze spending levels for a year and then have them grow really slowly next year. That wouldn't solve our debt, but it would save $1 to $2 trillion over a decade. I think we ought to go forward with that deal and then work together on how to build on it. What's happening now is the House wants to spend below the deal. The Senate effectively wants to spend above the deal. They're taking all this stuff and declaring it as emergency, even though it's totally ordinary spending. But nobody actually wants to abide by the deal. The first step is let's pass the spending based on the Fiscal Responsibility Act, and then let's go back for more because we have to cut spending a lot more if we are going to get our debt under control.
If we were to continue, Mark Goldwine, continue this trend that we've been seeing over the next decade, where would that put us?
To an ugly place. So remember, right now, debt is about 100% of the economy. The U.S. record is 106%. We set that right after World War II, and we had a plan to pay it down. If we continue on our current trajectory, within 10 years, we're going to be at 115 to 130%. Within 30 years, will be somewhere between 180 and 300% of GDP. There is no historical example of that working. There really isn't any international cases. The closest is Japan on that low end. That is a recipe for slow and stagnant growth, rising interest costs, more bouts of inflation, and possibly, hopefully not, but possibly a fiscally created financial crisis.
And what would it take to get out of that type of situation? How long would it take to get out of it?
So we should start now. If we were to put about $6 trillion of deficit reduction over the next decade, that would hold our debt to below the size of the economy. That would be an unbelievably important start. It's not easy. It would mean we'd have to cut tax breaks or raise revenue. We'd have to do more to restrict the growth of those appropriations. And we'd have to get serious about getting healthcare costs under control and restoring Social Security to solvency. But we could do it if we act now. If we wait to the crisis moment, it's going to require devastating, abrupt cuts that could put us in a recession and that certainly aren't going to feel good to the folks that really are relying on various programs and tax provisions.
That was Mark Goldwine, Senior Vice President for the Committee for a Responsible Federal Budget. Next, Victor Cha of the Center for Strategic and International Studies discusses the deepening ties between Russia and North Korea.
And Mr. Cha, North Korea's Kim Jong-un met with Russia's Vladimir Putin in Russia's Far East last week. What did each want from the other from this meeting?
Well, John, I would say at the first level, it's quite simple. Putin needs ammunition for the war in Ukraine. He's blowing through ammunition like nothing. And the North Korean leader needs food and fuel because they are just coming out of a 3-year COVID lockdown. And so it's basically a very simple transaction. It's food for arms. And I think that's what brought these two together in this very unholy alliance.
When was the last time these two met? What was the significance of the timing and the length of this meeting? It was several days.
Yeah, I think the last time they met was about 4 years ago in 2019. I think it was in Vladivostok. The timing of this one, I think, is very much related to the fact that Kim is coming out of this COVID lockdown. And we have to remember that North Korea is the only country in the world, I think, that had not vaccinated its population at all during COVID. So it closed its borders in January 2020, even with close allies like China and Russia. And it's completely stocked out and everything. It has no medicines. It has nothing. So I think this was the urgency behind at least the North Korean need, and the urgency behind the Russian need clearly was the need for ammunition. We've seen from this war in Ukraine that there was a shortage of munitions around the world, especially when we're talking about a war of this nature. And if there's one place in the world where there are stockpiles of munitions, it is on the Korean Peninsula, the most heavily fortified border in the world.
You talk about it. It's a pretty simple transaction here, food and fuel for arms. Concerns in this meeting about sharing nuclear technology, the ability to create and to deploy nuclear armed submarines. Is that concern on the nuclear level a little overblown here from this meeting?
No, I think it is a concern. And that's why I said on the first level, I think it's a transaction of food for fuel. But if you know Kim Jong-un, he would not travel all the way to Russia just for food. And so it does raise a concern based on the places he visited during this trip that there may be more behind this. Of course, they're not going to present some sort of formal written agreement for the world to see because every transaction, even food for fuel between North Korea and Russia, is a violation of UN Security Council resolutions. So they'll do it in a quiet, hidden way. But I think there is concern that the fact that Kim went to the first place he stopped was the space agency for Russia, which gives one a sense that Russia may help Putin, may help Kim with military satellite technology. North Korea has been unsuccessful in two launches of military satellites over the summer. So this raises real concerns that there is at the second level, not publicly seen, more that is happening between these two sides to advance North Korea's WMD program.
And then back to the arms side of this, does North Korea have enough arms to send to Russia that could tip the balance in Ukraine?
Yeah, it's a good question. And, you know, certainly in the open source, we don't have a lot of accurate information about how large their stockpile of munitions are. But I thought it was interesting that the first time the White House talked about a arms shipment from North Korea to Russia, this was at the end of last year. I think it was November of 2022. The NSC spokesperson John Kirby from the podium stated that there was a shipment of North Korean arms to Prigozhin, to the Wagner Group, in November of 2022. And I believe at that time he said that it wasn't enough to tip the balance in the war, but they were concerned about it nonetheless. I don't hear the administration saying that anymore. They are saying that they are concerned about arms shipments from North Korea to Russia, but they're not saying the second that they don't think it's significant enough to tip the balance. So, you know, in the world of government spokespeople and talking points, the omission of certain lines that they used in the past is often seen as significant.
Let's take this meeting from the perspective of some of the key Asian countries that were watching this meeting. What did it mean for South Korea? What did it mean for China?
So I think it's pretty clear that when we talk about countries like South Korea, Japan, Australia, they all clearly oppose this. They think it's a very bad thing, both in terms of aiding Russia in the war in Europe and in terms of what Russia might be providing North Korea that creates a more unstable environment in their neighborhood. For China, I think this is much more complicated. I don't think it's one-dimensional like it is for South Korea, Japan, and Australia. Because I think on the one hand, China doesn't like it when Kim and Putin get too close together. Historically, China didn't like it when the Soviet Union and North Korea got too close, or when Russia and North Korea got too close. So in that sense, there are impulses for China not to alienate North Korea and to try to cozy up to North Korea. On the other hand, you know, I don't think China wants to be seen as supporting something that is going to aid and prolong and aid the Russian side and prolong the war in Ukraine. I think China does care about its international reputation. It doesn't want to be seen as doing that. So I think it's a difficult position for China. Anytime North Korea does some sort of deviant international behavior, and that is quite often, the first people the international community blames is China, like because China has so much influence over North Korea. So it'll be interesting to see in New York at the UN this week, there will be wholesale condemnation of Russia and North Korea because of these summits. And I expect everybody, you know, the United States, South Korea, Japan, the EU, everybody to criticize it. And I'm really going to be interested to see what Russia says, what China says about it, because this will reveal some of their cards about how they feel about this arms transaction.
That was Victor Cha, Senior Vice President for Asia and Korea Chair at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. Next, we speak to Mary Dixon, an advocate for survivors of nuclear weapons testing in the U.S. during the 1950s and 60s. They are sometimes known as downwinders, and she explained what that term meant.
So a downwinder is someone who is affected by radioactive fallout from nuclear testing in the Nevada test site. So testing there started in 1951. It lasted till 1992. There were 928 nuclear tests there. Those tests would have fallout that went across the country, carried by the jet stream. The West was heavily, heavily impacted. My state, Utah, was heavily impacted. So the fallout would collide with rain, snow, sleet, or hail and fall to the ground, where it became part of the ecosystem and then became part of what worked its way into our bodies. So it was kind of a silent poison that we absorbed. I myself had thyroid cancer when I was in my 20s. I had my thyroid removed. I had lymph nodes removed. Years later, I also had other tumors that resulted in a complete hysterectomy. My older sister died at age 46, leaving three children. My younger sister has stomach cancer. Another sister has autoimmune disorders. The area we grew up in Salt Lake City, we counted 54 people who developed various cancers, tumors, autoimmune disorders. And my story is not an unusual one in the West, especially in the surrounding states, my state. So we became what we call casualties of the Cold War. Only we were never warned, we never enlisted, and we have never been fully compensated. So we have suffered. We continue to suffer. I've watched so many people die. I've lost so many people. All the people I worked with in Utah on this issue for years have all died. I'm the only one left. So when one of my friends died, she said, I need you to keep doing this work. She said, you got better. And I have felt an enormous responsibility all these years, which is why I have been working on this for the last 30, 35 years at least.
And Mary, you clearly have suffered, as many people have. But how do you know that these horrible diseases are directly linked to those nuclear tests that are caused by those nuclear tests?
Sure. And, you know, that's a good question, because you can never definitively prove that any one cancer was caused by any one thing. But the statistical probability is very high. We know from studies conducted by the National Cancer Institute in 1997, and this was, remember, 7 years after RECA was established, so more evidence keeps coming out. The National Cancer Institute did a study of radioactive iodine-131, which causes thyroid cancer, showing that virtually every county in the U.S. received some level of fallout. Of course, Utah and the West is almost blacked out, but it goes all the way to the East Coast and up into Canada. So they predicted that 212,000 people, up to that number in the U.S., would develop thyroid cancer or diseases from their exposure to I-131. So there's some confidence there that that's what caused it. We saw cancers in my area that we had never seen before. There were often no health histories in previous generations of those cancers. So we've seen that. There have been other studies done. There was, I know, a radiobiologist at the University of Utah who actually measured fallout coming from one test in 1962 and did measurements of milk showing the iodine-131 in the milk, and said that 55,000 children in my state, that's just my state, would likely get sick. There were other, I don't know if you've heard about the baby tooth study, but back in the 50s, there was a female physician in St. Louis who was worried about the strontium in the milk. And that's a bad one because it's absorbed by the bones. So it keeps radiating. Well, she started collecting baby teeth, and they ended up with this campaign, Donate Your Teeth to Science, that collected about 350,000 baby teeth when kids lost their teeth, not just from her area, but from elsewhere. And there is a study being done right now with a gentleman named Joe Mangano out of the Radiation and Public Health Project with Harvard University to look at the health impacts of those surviving kids because they kept track of every tooth. So there's been a lot of studies.
That was Mary Dixon, an advocate for survivors of nuclear weapons testing in the U.S. during the 1950s and 60s. Hear more interviews from C-SPAN's Washington Journal program on our website, cspan.org, on the C-SPAN Now app, or on C-SPAN Television, live every morning from 7 to 10 a.m. Eastern.